Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with film directors William Brent Bell and Angel Gracia. That's coming up on Endeavors. Well, hello, happy Tuesday, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. We are fully into the Christmas scene, and I am fully into my course here in the northeast of England at Newcastle University. But this show isn't about me. Obviously, the holiday season is a great time for films, and I've got two great ones on the menu for today. As many of you know, I love horror, and I love a good horror film, and my first guest, William Brent Bell, has made quite the name for himself in the horror community, and we'll also hear from director Angel Gracia on his Christmas-themed take on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, How the Gringo Stole Christmas. But, as I mentioned, my first guest is William Brent Bell, and he is one of those directors that has made a living in the horror world. Some of his previous outputs include Stay Alive, The Devil Inside, The Boy, Brahms, The Boy 2, and Orphan First Kill. He has a new folk horror film out called Lord of Misrule, and it revolves around the desperate search for the young daughter of the town's new minister. Rebecca Holland has recently taken over as priest of a small town. When her young daughter Grace goes missing at the local harvest festival, a desperate search begins. The closer they edge towards finding Grace, the more secrets emerge from the town's dark past. Soon, Rebecca must decide just how much she is willing to sacrifice to rescue her daughter from the grip of evil. The film stars Tuppence Middleton, Ralph Ineson, Matt Stokoe, and Evie Templeton. And it is being released on December the 8th. And this is my conversation with director William Brent Bell. William Brent Bell, hello, how are we today?
I'm very good, how are you?
I'm good. I'm actually about to get on a flight to London in about 4 hours.
No way, what for?
School. I'm going to have a month-long course that I'm doing up in Newcastle, actually. So,
have you been there before or much?
Yeah, like I spend half the time in the UK, so it's not foreign to me.
Yeah. It's less foreign to me now after this movie. I love it. I can't wait to go back.
Well, I was gonna say, I mean, this film has an all British cast, so it sounds like it was fully made in the UK, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, this was like started off as a British, it was a British production, and they brought me in a way, I think, well, I know sort of, because like you, I'm pretty enamored with the architecture and everything and the history and the lore there. Whereas, when you're around locals, they're pretty, they're not as impressed by their history as an outsider, but it was dirt, it was right at the end of COVID. So it was kind of like I was excited to be able to go over there and immerse myself in that world and with like a brand new crew and cast that was all British and all new, all from the UK. So it was, it was my favorite experience, making a movie.
How different did you find it making art over there versus making art over here?
Well, on one level, it's like everybody's very chill when it comes to how they're working. Like the actors will be sitting right by camera on set in between for hours sometimes. And it's very refreshing, that people aren't worried about their trailers and things like that. And then as far as the artistry, it's just that the level of talent is crazy over there and the taste level. And so it was a whole new cast and crew, but everybody was so trained and so skilled. And then they have so many resources available to them to be able to kind of create anything that it would have been really difficult to pull off in other places, things like the costume and different things like that. It was impressive.
Well, and you mentioned the architecture, and I think especially in a film like this and in the horror genre, buildings play maybe a greater role than they do in some other types of films. How important did that aspect of filming in Britain come into it?
I mean, it was the first most important thing, sort of, because they have so many tiny villages, and these villages have these rich histories. I mean, the village we shot in the center has a where they would burn witches, and it's still this monument to that. But when I first got there, we thought we would be looking at a couple locations where we would kind of cobble together to make it feel like one village. But then we found this village, Aldbury. And they allowed us to film the whole movie there. So it's crazy. I mean, the how old everything is and the way it looks. And for me, I would kind of try to shoot around it at times because the ceilings are so low and the doorways are so low. And I would worry about actors ducking. And then I kind of realized pretty quickly, like, well, that's the way it is. It's like that's the way what it looks like. But it was crazy. You could point the camera anywhere, and it was just beautiful and haunting and
Well, speaking of haunting, the opening scene, with that score, I felt like the music almost became a character, especially in that scene. And I think music is very important, in the horror genre for setting the tone. How do you work with your composer and your music supervisor to find all that?
It's a little bit different every movie. This one was, I worked with the same composer, Brett Detter. We've done six films together. And then the sound team, Craig Mann and his team, we've done six films together. So it's like the mood, we have a pretty good shorthand. And in the case of this, it's being that it was such a specific world I was kind of wanting to immerse myself into. A lot of turn It turned out a lot of what I was listening to is inspiration, like a singer, a vocalist named Sam Lee. When we tried to kind of find a way to make music that was inspirational from his, we ended up just calling him, and he came in and gave us two songs and sang two songs and one that we wrote together. And so it's a really fluid process, especially with something like this, because it's such a it always is, but this was to me so specific that I wanted the, like you said, the sound and the score to really help tell this kind of like very singular story of this village and these people.
You've had a lot of success in the horror genre with The Boy and Brahms. Orphan First Kill. What do you like about the genre that makes you keep coming back to it?
I would say like maybe two things. I mean, as far as the genre itself, it kind of allows you to tell any story that just kind of shows you a more horrific or terrifying side to it. But anything goes, and you can be as creative as you want to be, but you can tell, like I said, any kind of story that you want to, and dial up what your version or what you want to do with horror, you know, on this spectrum of what it is. A lot of people have kind of preconceived notions, but it's pretty much anything. And then I find in between movies, when I'm developing things that are maybe stepping a little outside of the genre space, that as soon as I get into like this part of the process or the testing process with the screenings, you know, you just don't like, if I'm doing a romantic comedy or a drama, I'm not going to have the kind of energy from the fan base of what this genre is. And it's just really exciting. And it just makes it so much more fun. And I'm like, ah, yeah. Like if I was just doing a regular movie right now, nobody would really, people would go see it and it would hopefully, you know, whatever. But not like this, not like the horror fans. They're just such a great family of people. And it's fun to make
We
movies with them.
we've moved away a little bit of the slasher films that were so common in the late 90s and early 2000s. How do you think we've expanded the idea of what horror is and what it can do?
You know, and it's always been amazing. I mean, you know, from The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby, movies back in the, even before that, but late 60s, early 70s kind of changed what people were thinking. You know, those movies being up for The Exorcist Academy Award nominated. Gosh, did it win? But, and then it just always takes a while for people to take the genre seriously, even though great films come out of it all the time. They usually treat those movies like an anomaly and say, well, is it really horror? It's like Jaws. Is it really horror? Well, of course it is, you know. And you know, a movie like Get Out. Well, but is it really horror? Of course it is. I mean, it's about, you know, brain swapping racist, you know, horrible people. And but the movie's so good. It's just a great film, no matter what genre. So I'm, you know, in a way, I'm not a huge fan of pigeonholing movies with the genre titles. I get it. It helps people understand maybe what they're stepping into. But like I said, anything kind of goes. And it's been really cool. Only really this last year or so have I felt for the first time that it's sticking to where executives and reps and producers are kind of looking at it as like, right, it's not just a fad. Because, you know, every 6 months, horror is back, but it's never gone anywhere. It's always here. And it brings people into theaters and, you know, it allows us to experience something together, which is different than a lot of genres.
For you, what makes a good horror film?
I think something that sticks with you know, and is unsettling long after you've left the theater. I mean, I think you could do a movie, and I've done movies in the past, perhaps, that is so, they're so fantastical that when you're watching them and experience them in the theater, it's like a roller coaster ride. But when you leave, you can take a breath and go, you know, all right, well, that's over. And what I love is when that person wakes up to go to the restroom at 2 o'clock in the morning, and when they're stumbling back to their bed, they think they see something in the shadows, and they realize that that movie has stuck with them, you know. And that to me is when a horror film's doing its best job. And I know that the movies that inspired me as a kid, it's like I'm still kind of haunted by them in strange ways. So that to me makes the best horror film.
Do you have a favorite horror film?
I mean, I have a series of favorites. I mean, I think if I had to choose one, I would say Halloween, the original. And I mean, I love Hitchcock and I love horror and I love kind of what Carpenter did with that. People, once again, they look at that franchise and they start to assume it's very slasher and very, and it did, it's done everything. But if you look at that first film, you know, he only really kills people in the last few minutes of the movie, other than a couple here or there, and it's the tension and it's the mood and the characters and the mystery. So I love that, you know, for sure.
You know, there's a long tradition in horror films of things happening to kids or kids being witness to stuff. And you have a few great child actors in this film, but as a director, how do you approach that, getting these great performances out of kids who might not fully understand the trauma that the characters are going through?
Yeah, and sometimes I forget because I think it's good they're kids. They shouldn't understand the trauma. They really truly are play acting. It's always been the audition process. It's always been, and that is even, of course, if you can imagine, more so with children, can be really difficult because, you know, it's they're kids. And when you see somebody, when you see a child actor that resonates, for me, then I'm like, that's the one. And I mean, in this movie, yeah, there's two really great kind of main characters who are children, and Evie in particular, who's plays Grace, the girl that goes missing. You know, she felt like an adult in a child's body, her kind of wisdom, you know, immediately. And then her look was just kind of arresting. She almost, you know, so it's tricky, but when you know, you know. For me, anyway.
And of course, your main character is a reverend played by Tuppence Middleton, and we're sort of seeing this. I don't know if it's a trend, but there's a lot of these movies that sort of blend religion and horror. I mean, even going back to The Exorcist. What makes those two such a good match?
You know, it's crazy because it's because people, you know, believe in God, and in believing in God, they believe in the devil, and they're very scared of the devil. And I mean, a huge, you know, segment of our population gets extremely frightened by anything like that because their beliefs are so deeply held there. So yeah, that's, I mean, it's something that like my movies have always played really well to those audiences, even if they aren't necessarily religious in nature. But I find that, you know, that the people who hold beliefs that they can't quite prove are usually the best person to be scared by a religious themed horror film.
In the course of making this film, was there a favorite scene or a favorite moment that you had?
I would say, yeah. I was thinking about this the other day, and I didn't, I mean, because I love, I mean, it was such a cool, I mean, I loved everything about it. But there was a scene in kind of the middle of the movie, and we're in these you know, these tiny, very difficult homes to shoot in, and they're also very delicate. And we had shot in the house a little bit, and kind of had shot every angle you could. And then we were having our first kind of big scene with the whole cast there in the house. And then I asked Simon Rowling, our DP, or one of us said it, I don't know who, but it was like, well, what if we just keep this the camera in the center of the house and then never cut? And so I knew I wanted to just make the scene about Rebecca, her character, kind of dealing with these people trying to keep her happy because her daughter's gone, and really she's not reacting to it. So when that cast, it was the first time that the whole cast worked together in one scene. They all expected we'd be shooting all day, all these different angles, covering the scene in all sorts of different ways. And instead, we just, you know, the scene is just one 360 shot around the house, and it plays out like a play. And there's a lot of fun timing that went into it. But at the end of the day, it was just very much about Rebecca, and it turned out great. And so it was kind of a spur of the moment idea that turned out to be kind of one of my favorite things about the movie.
How do you think that sort of perspective it can change maybe what people think the movie is about, or change how they kind of perceive things?
For me, I mean, because the idea for that scene was always to stay with her, or to for her to be kind of non-reactive to that scene. That scene in particular, you know, it's about these towns, these villagers coming over and just trying to make her happy and like nothing's wrong. And to me, what's most important is that we know that she's affected most by it. So in which case then the perspective kind of becomes everything, and everything that's happening around her is just this kind of dance, you know, and nothing is for me, I didn't want anything to be too much in the audience's face as far as what they were saying. It was just more the energy and this false positivity and optimism these people had is was kind of the point. And it's not necessarily about every little thing they said. It's more about this energy, which then to me is also very unsettling, because they're taking it too well, what's happening in this town. But she's not. So I don't know if that answers the question.
In horror films, I find it's definitely a fine line of emotions. Like there's the big sort of like, you know, screaming, but then there's also the more tempered reactions. What kind of conversations do you have with the actors and the rest of your crew about finding the right tone? Because that can often be tricky in a horror film.
I mean, for me, in a way, it's like I want to make sure that the actors are live wires when they need to be, and they can really tap into kind of a real fear and emotion as to what's happening around them. But more than anything, it's about that character's journey. And so with Tuppence for this film, when she first read the script, we sat down and we talked about it and had a good first meeting. And then I think I was in our first production meeting, and they called and they said, okay, Tuppence wants to meet again. She has, everybody was on their phone looking. There's like, she has notes. And I'm like, great. And so we canceled the meeting, and I went across town and I sat down with her, and really we, you know, picked apart every, challenged everything in the script to just go, well, what would this woman be feeling and thinking, you know? And then I went back and we worked on tweaking the script, you know, to her notes, which to me, you know, were the best notes, because she cared about every little detail and every little piece of motivation. And I could go through, you know, so many details that weren't initially in the script that she added. But, and I'll give you an example. You know, there's a scene when all the police are there, and they're questioning her, and she's, you know, fear for her daughter, and she doesn't feel like they're helping. And she goes upstairs. And the scene originally was just, she was in the bathroom looking at herself in the mirror. And she's like, well, she would be praying, you know, she's a vicar, she's a reverend. So it's like, of course she would. And so then that became more thematic in the moments whenever she was stressed out or in fear of what was happening. She would, of course, because that's her go-to, she would mention prayer or God, and we would lean into that. And it's details like that which are so important, and they only come about when an actor is, you know, really involved and really, what's the word I'm looking for? When you're,
Invested.
yes, invested.
I like that. Well, the film is Lord of Misrule, and it is in theaters and on demand on December the 8th.
Yes.
William Brent Bell, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. All righty.
Hey.
Cheers.
Later.
Once again, that was my conversation with William Brent Bell. He is the director of the fantastic new horror film, Lord of Misrule, which opens December the 8th. Well, from horror, we're moving into full on holiday comedy. And I don't know if you remember, but in the 60s, there was a great film with Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and I believe Sidney Poitier. and it was called Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, about this couple who are shocked when their daughter brings home a black man for as her partner for dinner. They kind of did a twist on it years ago with Bernie Mac and Ashton Kutcher, where the black daughter is bringing home a white man. Now there is a Hispanic twist on it, starring George Lopez, and it's called How the Gringo Stole Christmas. Obviously, the title is an allusion to How the Grinch Stole Christmas, but it's kind of a take on culture clashes and what happens when different, you know, people of different ethnicities get together, and you know, the overprotectiveness some parents go to. And it stars George Lopez, and Jack Kilmer plays the boyfriend. And the director of the film is Angel Gracia. And, you know, we talked about not only what Christmas means to him, what being in a Latino family means to him, but the origin and sort of meaning behind the word gringo, and how Jack coped with sort of being in this film. So this is my interview with Angel Gracia.
I respond to my social security number as well.
Okay. I mean, I don't know that, so, you know.
All right.
Angel Gracia, hello. How are we today? Oh.
Good, how are you?
I'm good. Just landed in the United Kingdom, so.
Oh, wow. So that's why it's night over there already.
Yeah, it's 5 o'clock and it's already pitch black in the Northeast here.
I remember those days. I used to live there.
Okay, yeah, I'm up near Newcastle at the moment. So
that's cool. Where do you live?
Well, I'm originally from the west coast of Canada, in Victoria.
Got it.
I'm in the UK for the next month for some school stuff. So
that's great, man. I miss London. So much stuff going on. Are you near London?
I'm about probably 4 hours on the train from London.
Oh, you're like, far. Okay, so
yeah, like I'm much closer to the Scottish border, but
there you go. Okay, you can do that. Freeze your butt and then go explore.
Yeah. So you have a new film. How the Gringo Stole Christmas.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, it's inspired by, you know, the classic film Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in a lot of ways. Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy. Was that film a really big influence for you?
Not really. So long ago I saw it that I was more thinking about Meet the Parents.
Okay.
Which I had it more fresh in my memory. And but it's, you know, essentially a fish out of water type situation, but within the same country, you know, and in the same language basically, but it's about basically putting someone that doesn't supposedly belong there in that place and being, you know, having to work his way through it, but that's essentially just an excuse to tell that type of story and have a bit of fun with it.
We're seeing a lot more films now that sort of, you know, cross cultural boundaries and mix kind of different, you know, ethnicities and backgrounds together. Where does the humor come from in these culture clashes, do you think?
I think that having lived in
in different parts of the US and in different countries in Europe. It's I think cultural confusion, where people think that just because you look different, sound different, or eat a different food, you know, you may be an alien, when in reality we're all the same, really. We'll go to the toilet the same way, is what I like to think. And so the fact that people do that everywhere, I find it funny. Because if I didn't find it funny, it's quite sad, right? So my point of it is, let's take advantage of the absurdity. And that's what that script had. And I just wanted to take it a little further. So I pushed it in the direction of my own experience as an immigrant everywhere I've been. I'm Spanish parents born in Venezuela, lived in different countries. So I really don't belong anywhere, and I don't care. I actually like that, and I embrace that. And so this film has just a emphasis on that particular don't belong here BS that creates humor.
You know, as someone who lives in the UK half the year, I really understand what you're saying. You know, you sort of you're from a little bit of all over, right? The word gringo, I mean, as someone who's been down in South America, I've obviously have familiarity with that term. I'm curious for you though, is gringo any white person, or it strikes me that gringo is maybe a specific type of white person?
For some reason, in a lot of South Latin America, they just use gringo as a North American person, right? And sometimes it's demeaning, and sometimes it just is. In Mexico, they'll call a white person güero, and but where I come from, we didn't use that word. It didn't even exist. And it's kind of the same thing. Like, this guy it's not from here, and he happens to have a lighter color of skin. Now, I've been called güero in Mexico, if you can believe that, and I don't necessarily qualify for that category. But by comparison to some group of people, they say, hey, güerito. Actually, some street thugs that was shooting a commercial, and I was in a camera car outside in the flatbed of the truck, you know, going through a bridge, and then we're parked at a light, and the guys go, hey, güerito, give me that jacket. And so I looked around to see who's the güero, right? Who is the foreigner here? And I realized they were talking to me. And so it's kind of absurd, because he has to apparently do to also with the color of your skin. So some classification of color palette. In photography, you'd just be like a lighter shade of the same color. So if you think about it, it's really absurd. And it's sad, really, what it is. But I'm trying to make it absurd so that I don't go to the sad part of it, and use comedy to highlight it and perhaps make you aware how stupid it is.
Why do you think we're often so set on categorizing ourselves in different ways when we're all really made from the same stuff?
Yeah, I think that that might have worked before, you know, science and, you know, DNA testing and microscopes, and you knew what we're really made of, the same thing. So I think it's just a traditional ignorance that we inherit throughout generations, right, of confusion. And it doesn't really make any sense, other than I think it's maybe an innate self-defense instinct that all animals have, and we have inherited it, which is, if it doesn't look like our herd, could be the enemy, reject and fight. That's how I rationalize it. And somehow millions of years of that, we still got some of that in there, and we just happen to add some creative thought to make it more sophisticated. But at the end of the day, we're just rejecting people who we think might be enemies, might not belong to our herd. And if you travel a lot, then you realize, oh, that doesn't make any sense.
In my experience, family ties are very important in the Latin American community. What does, and you know, Christmas is probably the biggest familial holiday of the year. What does Christmas mean to the Latin American diaspora?
I think it's not many people think carefully about the religious aspect or the roots of the idea. And it's just become a general great excuse to get together and see family members that we don't see all year. So it's just a great excuse to get together, eat a lot of food and give gifts to each other, and then swear you're going to be better next year, right? Yeah. In a way, I think it's just become a washed down version of that, but we latch onto the need to get together. And so, you know, I think it's half willing and half forced upon ourselves that we must gather and pretend to love each other. And then in January, we'll fight each other again after the Kings thing, because it kind of goes on and on and on in the Latin community. It goes all the way to the Three Kings.
Right.
So you're locked into this love affair until, you know, mid-January. And then you're released from it, so you can like hate each other again for a little bit until the birthday comes up.
Right. Is there, I mean, obviously here in, you know, North America, we have our traditional staples, you know, whether it's like sweet potatoes or turkey or whatever. Is there a traditional food that we would see on a Latin American table that Canadians, Americans might not be as familiar with?
We get different things in different countries because, so I was in Venezuela, raised there from Spanish parents, and there's just so much food on the table of all kinds of things that it almost doesn't make sense. It doesn't adhere to anything. There is some kind of a panettone that the Italians and the Spanish have. So it's kind of like a big bread that has like colorful raisins of kinds. It's kind of I never liked it. It was just tasted a little sour, bittersweet, weird thing. So there's a few things that kind of float around outside of the Christmas tree, and the nacimiento, we call it the birth of Jesus exhibit, right? Which is like a little thing underneath the tree. So I think there's more like props, and the food just becomes a lot of food, right? And champagne and grapes for some reason, right before midnight, but that's a New Year's thing. So I'm confusing two different things, from the Christmas to the New Year's thing. So in my brain as a kid, it was the whole thing. It's just all tied together.
Right. I'm curious, you know, it's about a Latina family. How was it working with Jack, you know, in terms of, you know, making sure he was comfortable with everything and just kind of the, you know, whatever a fun, but also misunderstandings may arise out of that during filming.
You know, he was game with being the victim of the situation, but perhaps because I told him, I don't want you to be that, right? I don't want you to just be the token white guy victim of the situation, but rather a loving guy who really wants to try hard to fit in and can really, you know, the challenges are too many, right? To succeed. But I want you to be smart about it, right? I wanna find out that you are actually, in fact, one of the two adults in the room. You and the other young person, your girlfriend, Lopez's daughter, are the mature, the adults. So if our younger generations, right, are smart about things, perhaps we can teach some of the old timers to change the way of thinking, you know, and wake up to the multicultural pot that we're in.
Given George Lopez's background, George plays the father, and with a film like this, was there any improv done at all, or was everything very much scripted out?
You start with a good script, and then in this situation, having so many comedians, I had to encourage improvisation, which I did with everybody. So Lopez pretty much owned his own lines and added a lot of banter, and a lot of one-liners come from him spontaneous, and he will do every take different from the other. And so did Mariana playing his wife. So did Carmen playing the aunt, and the Vatos outside. So here's the scene. We have to say this. We have to fit it in this time schedule. But I promise to give you a couple of takes for you to have fun with it. So we fulfill the contract with the scripts, so we make sense. And then you can add stuff to it and we'll see what works. And then it turned out to be that everybody's additional banter made it in.
A film like this strikes me that it would have a lot of kind of fun days on set. I'm curious for you whether there was, you know, maybe one scene or one moment or one day that really stuck out to you as your favorites, you know, for whatever reason.
Almost every day there was, I mean, it's difficult to make a film like this because we have so little time. We shot the movie in 14 days, which is about half the time you need to do something like this with very little prep time. So that is a very stressful situation for someone in my shoes. But having those guys acting in the film, you're bound to create fun in every situation. And so, and indeed, every time it was a laugh in some scenes more than the others, like shooting the soccer scene. You know, I have everybody and enough room to be funny in any way you want. So a lot of it was improvised almost on the day because we had no time to rehearse, right? Well, how about we did this? How about we did that? So keeping in mind the schedule, we had a good laugh on that, and it was 110 degrees Fahrenheit, which is like, I don't know, 45 Celsius. We're melting, but it was funny to have those characters trying to have a game and challenging each other. So that thing was a laugh. And the dream sequence, which I don't want to reveal what it's about, was hard to shoot because we were laughing so hard when we made these characters, the other version of themselves in the dream sequence. So yeah, there's a few moments where it was like biting your lips and getting through it. And with Lopez, pretty much every time I had him on, I had to, you know, tighten my jaw to not burst out laughing, destroying the take.
Well, it's filled with a lot of funny, hilarious moments. The film is How the Good and Goat Stole Christmas, and it is in theaters on demand and on digital on December the 1st. Angel Gracia, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Muchas gracias and Feliz Navidad.
Feliz Navidad. Cheers.
And once again, that was my conversation with Angel Gracia. He is the director of the new holiday film, How the Gringo Stole Christmas, starring George Lopez. And that is out on December the 1st. My thanks to Angel Gracia, my thanks to William Brent Bell, whose film Lord of Misrule will be out on December the 8th. That does it for me today. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.